Across Australia, you're with Tony Delroy on Nightlife.
You'll have to forgive me, the voice is a little bit rusty tonight. It's hanging in, but just a little rough around the edges. So if I sound a little strange this evening, that is the reason for it. If you need to SMS tonight, 0467 922 702. 0467 922 702. We probably all know someone whose favourite turn of phrase is, "Oh, I told you so." I knew I was right. And for those people who seem to thrive on being right, it seems sometimes even an unhappy outcome is preferable than having to admit to being wrong about something. But does the desire to be right get in the way sometimes of relationships? What are the costs of hammering home to everybody that you know better than everybody else? With us tonight is Dr. Russ Harris, psychotherapist, nightlife regular, and author of books The Happiness Trap and The Reality Slap. And Russ joins us in our Hobart studios tonight. Russ, good evening.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Mate, it's only natural, I guess, that we want to be right. Why is the desire to be right so strong in some people?
Well, I think everybody likes to be right. I mean, you know, it feels unpleasant to be wrong. And we learn this from a very young age, you know, and we get brownie points for being right, and adults reward us and praise us when we're right. And when we're being punished as kids, you know, we're made wrong and we're told we've done something wrong, or we've been naughty, or you've been bad, or you got it wrong. And you learn from, you know, it's just instilled from a very young age. It feels good to be right. It feels bad to be wrong. Mm. And we've all got that.
Why is it that we don't like to be wrong?
Well, it's painful. And obviously, it depends on your upbringing. But many people, you know, if you're lucky enough to have been in a family where people freely acknowledged their mistakes and admitted to being wrong and there was no shame in it, then you will have a different attitude to most of us. Most of us kind of, we're kind of brought up with the idea that you lose face when you're wrong, that there's something weak or silly about it. There's often some shame attached to it for most of us, and we don't like that.
Mm. It's really funny with some cultures. For example, the Japanese will tend to say yes if you are involved in a conversation or you ask a question. So regardless of whether it's yes or no, they prefer to say yes because it's culturally more acceptable. Is there a loss of face or a fear that people might not listen to you next time if you get it wrong?
Yeah, it can be that. I mean, there can be many, many factors that go into it, but it might be that you feel silly, or you feel ignorant, or you feel embarrassed or ashamed or anxious. You know, generally for most of us, being wrong brings up uncomfortable feelings, and so we don't like it. You know, one of the most useful lessons we can learn in life is to kind of freely admit to being wrong and own up to it. And it's easy to say, but it's quite a hard thing to do.
Mm. Be particularly strong for people in the public eye, wouldn't it? Who might fear sort of almost a loss of credibility if you say, "Oh no, I've got that wrong." But it's been a tactic, though, of more recent times for often politicians to come out and say, "Oh no, I screwed that up. No, I have done the wrong thing here," and da da da, and thereby you know, sort of almost cleanse themselves.
Yeah, how long did it take an Australian government to say sorry for, you know, those kind of, all of those horrible things that went on? You know, how long did it take for a pope to say sorry for, you know, abetting the Nazis in the Second World War? It's very hard for people in public places to come up and own up. But when they do, boy, what a difference it makes. What kind of praise do they tend to get when they actually own up and deal with it? And the problem is, I mean, you're so right, Tony, is that so many of the politicians model this kind of not being wrong, this kind of insisting on your right and trying to prove you're right and manipulating and distorting what you say so that you can be right at all odds. It's so rare that we see the opposite.
Mm. Peter Beattie used to say, "Oh no, I've screwed up here," you know, and freely admit, "But look, you know, we've made a mistake, but what we'll try and do is fix it next time." And yeah, it was an interesting approach, fairly refreshing.
Absolutely, yeah. You know when these kind of things, it's rare and incredibly refreshing, yeah.
Mm. What kind of examples do we see in the media of how politicians and journalists deal with being wrong? It's often said that if you make a mistake on page one, the correction is often on page 34 in very small print.
Exactly, if at all, you know, it's, I mean, newspapers are terrible at owning up to making mistakes or errors and so forth, you know. Politicians will do anything. They'll change the subject, talk about something else, blame someone else, insist that's not what they said, you know, go off on tangents, anything other than admit to a mistake. Mm. Because, again, the idea is making a mistake is perceived as weakness or silliness. And, you know, how refreshing would it be if they said, you're right, I made a mistake, I shouldn't have said that, I screwed that up, and here's what I'm going to do about it. Wow.
Yeah. Is there an optimal way to handle being wrong in the public eye, in your opinion?
Well, I think, is there an optimal way? I wouldn't say there's one optimal way. But
well, it's difficult because, you know, particularly in politics, parliamentary politics, you know, it can be picked over for the next 6 months if you admit to a mistake. And so you've got to do it carefully.
Yeah, you've got to do it carefully. But I would say if... you know, if everyone kind of knows you've made a mistake and you're just kind of stonewalling them or trying to deflect blame, it just makes it worse and worse and worse. It's very often the, you know, I think if you can find a way of owning up to some sort of error and just kind of recognizing that we're all human and come up with what you're going to do about it, that sends a very different message.
Mm.
But then, I guess there's many ways of doing that.
I guess just saying it very loudly doesn't mean it's true.
No, exactly, exactly. And saying it over and over again doesn't mean it's true.
Yeah. But tricky turns of phrase where, you know, and we quite often see it in shows like 7:30 where, you know, a difficult question is asked and they'll answer something completely differently. You know, it sort of will go on a complete tangent and, yeah. You know, sound very sincere, but, you know, not actually addressing the question at all.
Absolutely, absolutely. And another tactic is to kind of, maybe not so much in the public eye, but in private, behind closed doors, many people, rather than admitting to being wrong, will kind of start interrogating the other person and will define your terms. And what do you mean by that? Or go into a counterattack. All right, well, what about the time you did this or the time you did that? And so kind of deflect it from me by kind of blaming you or pointing the finger at you.
Yeah. Marty's just sent an SMS saying, "G'day, I was once wrong. Thought I'd made a mistake, but I was wrong." better fun. Can a reluctance to admit being wrong get in the way of an apology, which might well be deserved, or leave the other person feeling that they've really got a grievance with you because, you know, you aren't happy to acknowledge, you know, what had happened?
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, how healing is it to a relationship to own up and say, you know, I just realized what I was doing. I'm sorry about that. I was in the wrong there. I shouldn't have done that. Or that was a mistake. You know, that kind of response builds rich, meaningful relationships and is incredibly healing. But what happens if you try to deny it or pretend that you haven't done it or insist that you did nothing wrong? What effect does that have on a relationship?
I guess in our personal lives, friends or a couple or, you know, family members are arguing about something. What kind of impact does it have when, you know, one person's declared to be right and the other pronounced absolutely wrong? It can be very divisive.
Yeah, absolutely. Because as soon as I insist that I'm right, you're wrong. And that does not feel good for you. You know, so even if you are right, if you start insisting that you're right and hammering it home and making the point, and as you said earlier, you know, I told you, it's just so destructive. It's so destructive. So if you can be right but have a sense of humility about it and not shove it down the other person's throat, then it's much better. I mean, there's a famous poem by American poet Ogden Nash called The Wedding Cup. And he said, to keep your marriage brimming with love in the wedding cup, whenever you're wrong, admit it. Whenever you're right, shut up. Good advice.
Yeah, absolutely. We know some people seem to value being right above all else, and there's an argument involved even when discussing, you know, reasonably trivial facts. Why do you think some people have to be right so badly? You know, it sometimes, you know, damages relationships and damages their life.
Yeah, well, I think all of us at times fall into that trap. It'd be rare if we found someone who never kind of gets attached to being right. But obviously some people do it more than others. And I think there are different factors. One is, when you're right, you feel good. In the same way that you feel bad when you're wrong, when you feel right, you feel good. And when you feel righteous, that's even more, you know, kind of feels empowering and strong, and you've got the power. And so it can get a bit addictive for people. And that can also, you know, if being wrong for you is in your mind equated with being weak or silly or defective or powerless, or is kind of associated with shame or embarrassment, then you try to avoid it at all costs. So you kind of start clinging to being right as a way to avoid unpleasant feelings and thoughts. And that can easily get into a vicious cycle. And we see this probably at its most pronounced in people that we often refer to as narcissists. A narcissist is someone who's kind of very caught up with their own sense of importance and self-worth, and thinks that they are superior to other people and doesn't really kind of care that much about other people. Unfortunately, there's quite a few politicians that are narcissists.
Funny you should mention it. Jenny in Lilyfield has just sent an SMS saying, "Hi, Tony, is there any relationship between narcissistic personality disorder and not being able to say you're wrong?"
Absolutely.
Obviously, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, someone with narcissistic personality disorder is the extreme extent. You know, I'm wonderful and fantastic, and no one else is as good as me, and no one else matters as much as me, and often characterized by a lack of caring and empathy for others. And, you know, you would probably, if you had someone in your life suffering from narcissistic personality disorder, they would probably never have said sorry for anything ever, you know. They would probably never in their life have admitted to being wrong.
Does believing they're right help some people avoid taking responsibility, you know, by blaming adverse outcomes on other people's actions?
Oh, absolutely. How can I possibly take responsibility for my actions if I don't acknowledge that I've done anything wrong, if I've not made a mistake? You know, if I'm blaming other people, putting the blame, deflecting it, then that's kind of the absence of taking responsibility, you know. Responsibility starts by owning up to it, you know. It's kind of like we talked about saying sorry for those kind of atrocities that were committed on Australian indigenous folk. You know, we kind of, there's still a lot more work to be done, but it starts by at least acknowledging that we were wrong, you know. Let's take responsibility.
Mm. If you have that as a problem, does it often get in the way of personal growth?
Oh, massive. It's kind of, so in all my books, you know, A Happiness Trap in particular, I talk about the big dangers of what we call fusion with being right. Fusion means you get very caught up in your thoughts and feelings, and they kind of dominate you and push you around. And if you become fused with being right, it puts you in a position where you just can't learn, you can't grow, you can't have open relationships with people. It builds a barrier between you and whoever is on the other side of this, you know. And so you're, if you imagine a sheet of paper between you, you're looking at I'm right, and the other person's looking at I'm wrong, you know. It's so probably kind of, we can talk about two cardinal sins. One is looking good and the other is being right. And the more important it is to look good and be right, the more you're going to struggle with personal growth and building meaningful relationships.
Some people, I guess, would rather see a situation end badly than admit being wrong.
That's true. That's true. And, you know, and again, all of us have at times been in that situation. I can remember times when I knew that I was in the wrong, but I would not admit to it, and I'd fight back or blame or kind of, you know, kind of particularly in arguments with loved ones. And what about you and the time you did that? And it's just a, but then hopefully what I would do is once I calm down is then come back and say, you know, I'm really sorry about that. Actually, you were right. And it took me a long time to learn how to do that. I certainly wasn't very good at it in my teens and my 20s, but in my 30s and 40s, I've got better at doing that. And that's very healing for a relationship.
Mm. Does that sometimes paint us into corners that can make life really tricky? In other words, you know, even some of our nearest and dearest start to hate us.
It certainly can. I mean, you know, anyone listening, what's it like if you have someone in your life who's always right and never admits to being wrong? How difficult is it to be around that person? You know, what's it like if you've got a boss who's always right, or a teacher who's always right, or a parent or a partner who's always right? It's so difficult. And of course, it can paint you into a corner, because if you can't admit that you've done something wrong and you've very clearly have done something wrong, where do you go from there? Your only option is to lash out or cut off.
An SMS says, my dad never admitted he was wrong and insisted on holding grudges. Sometimes he held grudges for years, and he held a grudge against me for the last 7 years of his life. He died before I ever found out what I supposedly had done wrong.
Well, I'm very sad to hear that. It's a very sad story, and a not uncommon story, unfortunately.
How can we recognize if we do have a problem that needs a bit of correction in this area? Because, you know, always being right, you probably don't see the flaws.
Well, there's the catch-22. The person that's always right is probably unwilling to have a look at themselves. You know, the kind of the person with, for example, a narcissistic personality disorder would be incredibly confronted if you said to them, you know, are you ever wrong? Do you ever make a mistake? Have you ever in your life, you know, apologized for something or owned up to doing something wrong? They would probably get highly offended at that question, because, of course, you know, that question would bring up a lot of anxiety for them. You know, it would be incredibly confronting to realize that you never, ever admit to being wrong. So if you're not that extreme, though, anyone else who's less extreme than that, you know, then it's kind of useful to have just ask yourself the question, are there relationships in my life where I'm clinging to being right, where it would work better for me to own up to being wrong?
Can you work on letting go of that desire to always be right? I mean, and how would you do it?
You certainly can work up to it. You know, it's kind of, as you know, Tony, I'm a big fan of mindfulness, and my books are based on people learning mindfulness skills. Mindfulness is a mental state of awareness and openness and focus, and we can, in a state of mindfulness, learn how to let thoughts and feelings flow through us instead of controlling us. So the first step would be to start noticing your patterns of behavior. Reflect over your day. Where did you get caught up in being right? Where did you deny a mistake or blame or get into a fight? Or if you could relive that time, what would it be useful to do differently? If you could go over it and respond differently, is there a way that you could own up to that you could apologize, that you could kind of make amends? And just start reflecting on your day in retrospect and start to notice these patterns. Most of us, they're kind of regular patterns that recur. When do we cling to this stuff, and what could we do differently? That would be a starting point.
What if you've got a family member who's obsessed with being right to the extent that it's really destroying relationships? Is there a good way to raise the topic even?
Yeah, it's tricky. Again, it depends on how attached they are to being right and how extreme they are. You know, if you can, these things are always best addressed calmly and in a time and a place where there's the greatest chance that the other person is open to listening and that you're in a calm space yourself, and set it up. You know, there's something I'd really like to talk about with you. I want us to have a better relationship, and there's something going on here between you and me that I'm finding very difficult. That would be a starting point. And then in non-judgmental language, describe what's happening. If you say, you're always right and I'm always wrong and that really drives me mental, then, you know, that's not going to be very constructive. But if you can say, we tend to get into this pattern here, and it tends to be, it tends to go this way. We start getting into a game of right and wrong and trying to kind of prove each other right or wrong. And, you know, I find I don't really want to play that game with you. I find it's very unpleasant.
When does the desire to be right become righteousness?
Yeah, so it's interesting because the word righteousness really, it means morally upright, without guilt and without sin. It's a religious term originally, but you know, we are, we are we often kind of talk about righteousness really in a way that's divorced from its religious underpinnings, just kind of, I have the absolute truth, and I know that my way is the right way, and my morals are the right ones, and I, the moral high ground, and if you don't follow me, and if you don't agree with me, then your morality is not as good as mine. So it easily spills into a sense of superiority and a kind of dismissiveness of the other person's point of view.
Yeah.
It can be very dangerous. It can be useful too, you know. I mean, kind of, you know, a righteous indignation can be motivating to actually stand for change and live your values and take a stand on an important topic. But you've got to be careful with it.
Jono says, I thought I'd married Miss Wright, but I just never realised that her first name was Always.
I hope she's not listening to the show.
Exactly. Dave from the Central Coast says, I find that people who never own up to rightness are nearly as irritating as those who won't admit to being wrong.
Interesting.
Is it helpful to point out to other people that they're wrong or right about something? You know, I guess, you know, particularly with the child these days, they tend to prefer not to say that you're wrong, but, you know, that, you know, give a phrase that will encourage.
Yeah, I think one of the things is rather than you're wrong is that idea is incorrect or that pattern of behavior is unhelpful. Or that didn't work out as intended. So the emphasis is not on you. You are wrong, but that idea or that pattern of behavior or that action was kind of unproductive or unhelpful or inaccurate. It's a very different way of speaking.
Mm. Dr. Ross Harris is a guest tonight, a psychotherapist and author of The Happiness Trap and The Reality Slap. Just wondering whether perhaps you've seen something tonight in yourself. Perhaps you find it really difficult to say, oh, yeah, I am wrong. Or perhaps you've dealt with somebody who was impossible in that area and it made the relationship quite difficult. We've already had a couple of examples where a father who just, you know, cut the child off rather than actually talk to them after, an incident. We're talking tonight, I guess, about, you know, relationships at work, at school, at home, and, you know, building better relationships, but dealing with somebody who is never wrong.
It's Nightlife.
Yeah, an interesting SMS says, I'm nearly always right because I keep my mouth shut if I'm not sure. Dr. Russ Harris, psychotherapist and author of The Happiness Trap and Reality Slap, and we're talking about difficulties with guys who are never wrong. Scott, your father had some wise words.
Yeah, he still says it now. It always makes me laugh, and I find myself saying it. Is I'm not often right, but I'm never wrong.
Yeah. Absolutely. Was it an issue for him, or he was just having a bit of fun?
He just always says it. You know, if you don't agree with him, he'll just always turn around and say, "I'm not often right, but I'm never wrong," and you know, you have a bit of a laugh.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for that. Good to hear from you, Kyla.
Yes, Glenn.
What's your story?
I just have a couple of people who refuse to ever be wrong. I think Elton John put it very well when he said, sorry seems to be the hardest word.
Yeah. So, in other words, it's a situation where, despite the fact that they've wronged people, they would never even acknowledge it.
Never, ever. Whereas I will say, sorry, too many times a day.
Yeah. Ross?
Yeah, I mean, sorry is such a powerful word and a very hard word for many people to say. And you don't want to go the other extreme either, though, the person who's always apologizing and always sorry and always making themselves out to be wrong, even when they've done nothing wrong. You know, that's equally problematic.
Good on you. Thanks, Carla. An SMS from Lou says, my husband cheated on me. Our relationship was never the same after. I found it hard to forgive him. He told me he lived with the guilt every day. He took his life 6 years after, and now I live with that guilt. Russ?
Oh, that's very, very hard, and you know, very important that we practice self-compassion, being kind and caring to ourselves. You know, life brings up all sorts of hard and difficult events for us, and you know, self-compassion is another very useful skill. To learn how to recognize my pain and suffering and reach out to myself with genuine kindness and caring. And that's what's called for here.
Yeah, and your ability to forgive yourself as well. You know, you weren't to know that that was going to happen.
Yeah, and it's not your fault. You know that logically and rationally, but your mind's not going to accept that. It's going to beat you up for it. So this is another way that mindfulness plays a role, learning to unhook yourself from those kind of self-punitive, self-judgmental thoughts, and learning how to come back and be kind to yourself. And we can't tell the future, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Daniel, you're asking how to deal with a relationship when someone is right more often.
Yeah, there seems to be an assumption here that people are right and wrong in equal amounts, but you can have a situation where someone is far more knowledgeable in an area, or one party is in a relationship, and how do you deal with that when one person, you know, doesn't just think they're right more often, but is right more often?
Well, I think the way you deal with it is cultivating humility and kindness. You know, there's nothing wrong with being right. The problem is when you get, you know, all caught up in your rightness and you start forcing it down on other people, or you deliver the fact that you are right in a way that is judgmental or critical or superior or arrogant. That's where the problem comes. But, you know, like as a parent, for example, you'd expect to be much more knowledgeable than your young kids. And how you impart that knowledge, if you impart it with kindness and openness and in a way that doesn't kind of criticize or put down the other person, then you're doing something very useful. But this is the huge difference between saying you are wrong as opposed to saying, well, that idea is not quite accurate, or that pattern of behavior is not particularly useful in this context. So kind of being right, but with an attitude of humility and openness and kindness, I would say.
What do you think, Daniel?
Yeah, it's difficult. I was thinking also in terms of professional relationships, or in terms of board members or committee members and controlling a club and things like that. You know, sometimes people can have decades more experience, and everybody has an opinion. You know, it's very difficult trying to work out how to give people the benefit of that knowledge and experience without having them think that you're always right, or that you're saying you're always right.
Well, again, that's difficult, and there's not a simple answer for that. One piece of the puzzle is to kind of validate and acknowledge other people's opinions and ideas, even if you disagree with them, and even if they are not as practical or useful or accurate as yours. Find something to validate and acknowledge in them, and thank people for their participation and their input. That would always be a good starting point.
All right, mate. Sure. Good luck, Daniel. It's a difficult one. Richard, you were taught to admit your mistakes when you were very young.
Yeah, my father did. He taught me sort of know when you're wrong and admit it and say sorry. And I carried on with my children, and I basically told them that if I said no, they had the right to come back at me and tell me if I was wrong or not. My daughter never did, but my younger son was brilliant at it. And 9 times out of 10, he was right, and I had to say sorry to them. But if I did say no, they knew no was the answer, and there were never any problems.
That's wonderful. You know, I wish I'd been brought up that way. That's, you know, the polar opposite of how I was brought up. But, that's a wonderful, if you can lucky enough to create that atmosphere in your house and bring up your kids, what a great job.
Did you encourage them a lot, Richard? You know,
definitely, all the time.
Could you explain to us how you did that?
How I encouraged them?
Yeah, how did you encourage them to, you know, speak up and to have their thought and, you know, to be better human beings?
I basically let them know they're on the same level as me, and they had the right to say how they felt about things. I never stopped it. And they sort of, my son, it was started from, when was the first time I think they did? When they used to go to underage rages, about 7 years old. You know, I was dairy farming then. I could have been in a bad mood, and I'd say no. And Sam would say, Dad, you're wrong. Why?
It's just lovely sometimes to be listened to, you know, particularly when you're young and developing. You may not have all the answers, but at least, you know, the person who you respect listens to you.
Well, with my daughter, I sort of, you know what young girls are like, sort of she'll be in a bedroom and she'll be talking about the most absolutely ridiculous things, but they're very important to her, and I listen to her. And she was happy that I just listened. Whether I sort of thought it was important or not, it didn't matter, but she was happy that I just listened.
Yeah.
I think sort of active listening, I'd call it, I suppose.
Good fun. Thank you for that, Richard. Thanks for the lesson. Karen, you are struggling with living with someone with Asperger's.
Oh, yeah, I've struggled for 20 years. But I'm finding
it does require a special talent.
It does require a special talent. I've got my husband and son on the spectrum. And my son I brought up, my husband I did not, obviously. So it's a different argument with each each person, okay? But I find myself with my husband, it's easier just to shut down.
Which at times is tough, isn't it? You know, having to bow every time is difficult.
Yeah, well, I've just lately stopped. Because, and also too, you know, there's no shade of grey in the middle. With someone on the spectrum, it's, you know, it's either black or white, it's polarised, and you can't win the argument no matter what you say or do. But now I'm just starting to say no.
Yeah. Ross?
A very difficult one, and again, lots of need for self-compassion here, difficult, complex situation. You know, unfortunately, shutting down does tend to happen when you're with someone who is always kind of right and just keeps hammering it home. If you're in a relationship like that and you think that there's the possibility of change, it's very good to have a conversation about the whole being right and being wrong. A useful question to ask is, would you rather be right or would you rather have a loving relationship? You know, and what happens when you cling to being right, and talk about what it's like for you to be wrong and how painful and stressful that makes the relationship, and kind of see what kind of responses you get.
Well, that's probably what's happened in the last 10 days. And but I find it so much easier than having and we don't yell and scream, you know, we do have a proper discussion about it, but I found it so much easier emailing him.
Yeah, well, because...
Does that sound right, you know?
It's
just working, you know, because he gets me in such a twist with what I'm trying to say, and also, too, he's far more educated than myself, so some words come in there, and I think to myself, oh, goodness me, give me a minute to work that one out, you know?
Yeah. Well, emailing can work really well for some people. You know, the bright side of emailing is that you're calmer and you can think it through and the other person can read it and reflect on it. The dark side of emailing is if you kind of send the email in the heat of the moment while you're all caught up in your anger and you've written things that you regret and you didn't really want, and they're there in black and white, and that's the dark side of it. It sounds like it's working for you.
I guess, Karen, also it's a bit of an issue when there's two persons in the household who are doing this similar sort of thing.
Oh, yeah, and they're at loggerheads. Absolutely. You know, they're totally at loggerheads. It gets to the point where my son switches off from his dad, which is not good because it's in a relationship that I think every young man needs to have, you know. And see, I never go to the dark side, which is, and I don't write anything that's heated. So, but I do express my feelings quite succinctly and sometimes a little bit too abrasively. But my son at the moment, you know, I'm trying to get him to recognise that he can be wrong. But this personality on the spectrum finds it incredibly hard to admit they're wrong. Mm. You know, there's nothing I can do to teach him to admit that he's wrong, because it gets to the point I get totally frustrated and I just say whatever and go.
Yeah. Very hard. Again, one of the things that can be useful here is to move away from your wrong and talk about that pattern of behaviour is unworkable, or that pattern of behaviour is unhelpful, or that pattern of behaviour is not helpful for our relationship, or holding on to that idea is creating problems, or, rather than you're wrong, kind of depersonalise it can be helpful. There's no simple answers here, but these are little bits and pieces that can make a difference. And when I work with couples, I write on a card, I give them a card, and on one side I write the words, "I'm right." And on the flip side, I write the words, "You're wrong." And I get them to take it home and place it on the fridge or somewhere prominent. And when they start getting into a game of "I'm right, you're wrong," the first person to realize takes the card and gives it to the other person. And it's a way of saying, "Oh, look what we're doing here. We're caught up in this." And, you know, that question, would you rather be right or would you rather have a loving relationship, helps to kind of step back.
No, that's a good idea, because I brought my son up on pictures, so that might be something I can use with him.
Good luck, Karen. Thanks so much for the call. Mick, you claim that you're right more often than you're not, and you believe it's terribly annoying.
Yes, exactly. I have the ability to see things that are about to go wrong or where people are going to make mistakes. So I try to warn them, tell them the right way to do things so that things won't go wrong, or even if people ask me information, if they don't believe me, they go and stuff it up, and then I am so sick of being told, "Oh, you were right."
Interesting. Yeah. Russ?
Well, again, as long as it's delivered with humility and openness and kindness, it's likely to be helpful. But if it's delivered with kind of frustration or superiority or "I know best," it's not going to be well received. Like, you know, talking about raising your kids, you know, my little guy is 8. And one of the things that I'm teaching him is it's okay to make mistakes, and making mistakes is an important part of learning. We all make mistakes, and you can't get good at anything without making mistakes. And I want him to make mistakes and learn from that and realize that it's perfectly okay. And that's where the best learning happens. You know, obviously, I don't want him to make stupid mistakes like playing in the middle of the road and getting hit by a car. But there's lots of other mistakes that I actually want him to learn from, and to be able to say, "Oh, I made a mistake and I did it wrong, and how can I learn from this?"
Well, I have a son who didn't grow up with me. He saw me at various times through holidays and whatnot because we lived apart. But whenever we parted, I'd say to him, "Remember, 3 little things. Be good, be polite, be honest." And that type, I think that he still remembers that today, and he's 27. He is a good boy, and he is honest. If he makes a mistake, he admits it. But
that's good. That's great.
I don't know whether he's trying to emulate me or not, but he tries very hard not to make mistakes. Yeah. The easiest thing is, before people go into things, do a bit of bloody research.
Sure.
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Mick, thank you for that. Pamela, you say Lifeline training helped you with your communication.
Changed my life, but I'm part American, and we're not afraid to read self-help books. The Dance of Anger is a brilliant book. Harriet Lerner, The Dance of Fear. She did that one after 9/11. It's funny. You know, I'm a self-helpaholic. Because I'm such a dreadful person. Mm-hmm. Volunteering, that's how I met Dame Elizabeth.
Oh, yes.
Oh, I'm not going to cry now, but it took me till 3:30 in the afternoon to pull myself together. I was, she'd cried, died.
Yeah.
When I was going through my training, they said, "Now, you've got to know who the VIPs are." And I'm pretty outspoken. And I said, "Excuse me, I'm offended. I'm sorry, I have to interrupt. But I always taught my children, treat everyone with dignity and respect, because you can't lose." And I've just got to tell you a little example. I met this beautiful little boy with, not Bell's palsy, cerebral palsy. He's only 3. He's gorgeous, and he can walk faster than me, Tony.
That's lovely. Yeah, treat people with
isn't
dignity
that
and respect.
Darling little boy, I've got to. I just want to go and visit him, and he's so popular. And I sang. I didn't know what to sing to him, so I said, "All you need is love. da-da-da-da-da, all you need is love, love. Yeah. I'm related to one of the Beatles. We've spoken before, years ago, Tony.
Yes.
I'll get off the line now because there's a lot of other people waiting.
Well, I would just say, you know, what you've said there, dignity and respect are so important, and often they fly out of the window. When we get fused with, I'm right, and I know best, and you're wrong, we don't treat the other person with dignity and respect. It disappears. So one of the benefits of learning to hold your own sense of being right more lightly and not get caught up in it means that you can be more respectful to others.
Thanks, Pamela. SMS says, I remember as a teenager saying sorry to my father once after an argument, and he refused to accept it. He didn't speak to me for 2 months. He claimed it was being in shock, confused, exhausted, and then withdrawn, fearful, depressed, agoraphobic.
Yeah. Incredibly destructive. So John Gottman, one of the world's leading experts into relationships and what makes them kind of work, talked about repair attempts. So a repair attempt is after something has damaged your relationship. A repair attempt is something you do to try to repair. And the most obvious one is, I'm sorry, you know, and I made a mistake. And if the other person doesn't accept your repair attempt, it is so destructive. It magnifies the original damage tenfold or a hundredfold. If somebody does come up to you and say, I'm really sorry, what I did was wrong or whatever, even if you're still furious, if you can at least acknowledge and say, well, thank you for that, even if you're still furious, then you're doing something useful. But if you won't accept it and you give them the cold, silent treatment or it's too late or I don't care, you're just magnifying the damage. Mm.
Russ, thanks so much for being there tonight. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Dr. Russ Harris, psychotherapist and author of The Happiness Trap and The Reality Slap.